Okay, guys, okay. In its own twisted way, everything until Parshas Korach makes sense. It's betrayal, it's cowardice, it's mutiny. But each in their own way, the Egel, the Meraglim, the Misonanim, Miss Avutaba, Miriam, Aaron, as tragic and sad, as pathetic and relentless as it all seems, you can climb into the minds and the imaginations of all these rebels and all these unfortunate failures and understand their position, where they're coming from, what they're suffering, the highs and lows of religion. How could it be that weeks after Har Sinai and Nasa and Ishma, they fell prey to the Egel? The answer is the most dangerous moment in Avodas Hashem is right after you've had a religious high. Because there's something about your psyche that seeks equilibrium, at least the equilibrium of your past, and you're ironically more vulnerable when you leave yeshiva the first week at home, all of a sudden to let loose some of that pent-up energy and that coiled tension, or when you go home for vacation. Does that make sense? They're bored. Every day the same food. We want meat. We want something exotic. The food isn't being digested according to Chazal. They were bored with life. So there's avutava. They wanted adventure. They wanted fantasy. The great addiction of modern man. Rather than facing the existential questions of life, he'd rather entertain himself into addiction. Video on demand. Video on demand should be called vacuum on demand. It's an existential vacuum. It's VOD. Vacuum on demand filled by video on demand. Makes sense. The Meraglim, it's also a hard place. Israel doesn't take any prisoners. Eretz Ocheles Yosheveha. To live here, you have to have a stout heart to know that you're part of history. To know that the rules that apply under normal conditions in normal countries don't apply here. The economy, the politics, the climate, the people, the history. It should be an honor to be a part of it. People with prophetic and religious constitutions want to be part of something larger than themselves. They don't want to be on the sidelines, but there's a ticket of admission. There's a price of admission to life in Israel. And that ticket is not a price that the Meraglim are willing to pay. The Ma'apilim. Sometimes it's hard to know when not to push forward, when not to advance. We're so ready now. We've been berated. We've been chided. Now let's enter the land of Israel. Sometimes it's hard to remind people that there's a pace to even Gula. And human beings can't always accelerate it based on their timetables and expectations. Miriam and Aaron, to some degree, their jealousy is warranted. It expresses itself in a libelous and scandalous fashion, speaking negatively about Moshe, but we certainly admire their desire to be equivalent to Moshe. They don't sink into a fetal position and accept the fact that they're inferior to Moshe in their prophecy. They feel empowered and desirous of equal prophecy, and all that are made out of the same. They want to be. Everything until now can be justified, can be explained. But this parsha is just preposterous. This parsha is just perplexing. You guys are, yeah, you're all too young. You're post 2000. But there's a president of the United States who was on course to be known as one of the greatest presidents in American history. And through a moment of silly indiscretion, he forfeited it all. His name was William Clinton. You know him as Bill Clinton. The economy in the mid-90s was humming like never before. The United States wasn't embroiled in any international skirmishes of any note. This was pre-terror, so there was a relative calm and safety. The United States enjoyed hegemony in the post-Cold War environment. Russia dared not challenge the United States' supremacy. So there was a television correspondent who once interviewed celebrities. She's no longer that active. Barbara Walters, you may have seen some of her past work. She actually had an interview with him after his scandal with a summer intern in the White House, a teenage girl. And I think they had asked her before the interview, what is the question you're going to ask Bill Clinton? Because this is a long-awaited interview. And she posed a question that I always thought would be better posed to Korach than to Bill Clinton, but it equally applies to Bill Clinton. What were you thinking? What were you thinking? I can understand Nixon. Break in, get away with it. Sabotage. I can understand mistakes. You get caught. Conspiracies. You have a chance. The entire free world is watching. This isn't high school gym. This is the White House. There are people around. There's reporters. There's correspondents. There's secret security agents. What are you thinking? You forfeited your whole career, your whole reputation for a moment of silly folly and lunacy. Dementia. So I feel like asking Karach that same question. Karach, what were you thinking? You're now wrestling with the big boys. This is Moshe Rabbeinu. Remember the 10 Makos in Mitzrayim? He's got it. He's got 10 Makos up his sleeve. Remember the ferocious waters of the Yamsuf? He split them like Swiss cheese. Walked right through. Remember the fire on Har Sinai that terrified everyone? Walked freely into it. Remember all those times Am Yisrael was slated for oblivion? One person intervened. Remember the Mishkan? One person built it. Why, who are you challenging? What do you expect? Where are you heading with this? And even more so, even if one person can be demented, how does an entire people become swayed by such sheer lunacy and idiocy? It's idiotic. What's going on? What? This isn't some second-rate fallout from society, some dropout. This is Korach. He's a prince. He's a leader. He's the head of his tribe. He's one of the advanced members of the Levi team. And what's his mistake? What's their mistake? So two questions, unfortunately, because I was late today. Less time than I'd like to, so let's deal with the second question first. We'll go back to Korach's delusion, but let's first study how he conveys and convinces. There's a term which you sometimes misconstrue, or more accurately, you don't misconstrue it, you circumscribe it, and you limit it rather than expanding it. It's called Leitzanus. When I say the term Leitzanus or Leitzanut, you think about maybe dirty jokes, maybe sarcasm, maybe cynicism, you're always putting people down, someone offers good advice, sincere, you're always chopping them down, saying something negative, negating, that whole range. That's just the extreme and radicalized version of Leitzanus. There's a different form of Leitzanus which feeds it and which, if left unchecked, can yield that type of extremism. And that's what Korach possessed. And that's why he is referred to by Chazal as the prototype of a Letz. If you look at source number Beis, the first pasuk in Tehillim, Ashrei Ish, Asher lo halach ba'atzas rishayim uvederach chataim lo amad uvemoshav leitzim lo yashav. Source Beis, part one, who's the Moshev leitzim? Zekarach. Korach was a stand-up comedian in Seinfeld. Every time Moshe said something, he had a one-liner and he told dirty jokes about Moshe. Why is Korach referred to as a letz? You don't see any conduct of irreverence and leitzanus in the form of that we normally associate with sarcasm, cynicism, a little bit of a flair. Halo tisterer, leinu gam histerer. There's a little bit of an inflated, bombastic tone to him, like he's playing to the crowd. It's theatrics, histrionic opposition rather than substantive conversation. A little Trump in him. Let's not discuss the substance. Let's just make fun of one another. You know, you made your point. You don't need the flourish. Hello, Tisterer, Leno Dam Histerer. Who are you, Shakespeare? Okay. But there's something deeper than that. And Chazal point and associate Leitzanus not with cynicism and sarcasm, but with something else. And it's called demagoguery. And Korach's the prototype demagogue. How does demagoguery begin? How does cynicism, even if not expressed in a sharp-tongued, defamatory fashion, where does it all start? So, I'm happy you're back, Elon, because we need you. Do you have tissues? Does anyone have tissues here? Okay, so if anyone needs tissues, please don't hesitate to run to Hillel, because this is going to be a real tearjerker. Okay, so get ready. Sit down here. Okay, anyone who's got weak eyes, too much visine, too much pollen, maybe you want to leave now. Here's the story that Korach tells the mob. But really, if you have a predisposition to tears, you may want to step out now. Here's the story. Get ready to cry. Hischa lomar lefnehem divrei leitzanus. He begins his trajectory of leitzanus. I don't see any jokes here. There's no Seinfeld. There's no comedian here. No one's making fun of anyone. By the way, you can probably discern my disrespect for comedians. And don't be careful not to be respectful of them. They're smart, and we'll talk about how intelligence yields this whole realm, but first of all, don't ever be impressed with people who are smart. Be impressed with people who are moral, caring, sincere, hardworking, earnest, devout. Intelligence is just like body height. They're more brain cells or less brain cells. Shouldn't be impressive to you. You should use whatever tools you have to serve a better powerful, but when you see someone with intelligence, not a reasonable, and be in awe of that person. And something with that intelligence feeds sarcasm. And again, if it's fun, you're making fun of your friend, your sibling, all good fun, but sometimes it's really biting. Something we're very impressed with it. And I'm not impressed with it. Very under-impressed with it. So here, Korach tells the following story. You ready? Amar lahem al manacha, source base, part one, line three, haisa bishchinati. There was a poor widow who lived next door to me. You can just imagine with her milk bonnet and her long, we'll honor some of our redheads today, her long red braided side locks. Right? Let's personalize it. Poor Almana, her husband passed away. Line number three, Ve'ima Shtei Naros, two lovely girls, Molly and Polly, just wholesome, healthy, earthy, wonderful girls. V'hayilam sadachas. And they were left, Nachman is only with one single field. And they planted that field. Bas lachosh. And they wanted to plant. And before you plant, as all you Shabbos warriors know, you have to plow. You have to plow the land before you seed it. Line number four. Amar Moshe! Now the sinister Moshe walks into the scene with the handlebar mustache and the greasy, slick back hair. Says, Lo sacharo shar b'chamor yachdav. Women, ladies, let's make him really a racist and a male chauvinist also. Ladies, stop plowing, stop dead in your tracks because you have an ox and a donkey side by side and you're not allowed to. Okay, so these pure and wholesome women, these chivalrous princesses are very obedient. They cease their illegal activity. Line number five, Bas Lizra. Now she plowed the way that Moshe wanted her plow. She wants to seed the land. Moshe comes running back in, twisting his side of his handlebar mustache and said, ha, I have you again. Sadcha lo tizra kalayim. Don't you dare throw the grains and the wheats together. Okay, they submit. Line number five, Bas Lixar. Now she wants to harvest. Velasos arema. She wants to stack her grains. They're poor. They need it. Amar Moshe comes in once again, laughing mercilessly. Hinichu leket, shechacha, pay up. You have to pay up, woman. Pay up, lady. Where's your leket? Where's your shechacha? You think you're going to eat tonight? You got to pay the piper. Pay me first. Pay Aaron first. Pay the poor people first. Bas lasos lagarin, line number six. Okay, she left over all the stuck-in charity of the non-collected sheaves. Now she stacks the sheaves, and she thinks that now she can finally get a good wholesome meal. Little cup of porridge, that's all Goldilocks wants. Moshe says, huh, you probably forgot Trumos and Maestros. Pay up. You paid address number one, now you got to go to window number two and pay double. And you can just see the abuse and the venom spewing out of Moshe's mouth and the hatred radiating from his beady little eyes. So they accept it. Masa, line number seven, says, you know what? I can't take all these rules and regulations, all this abuse and exploitations. I'll sell the field. I'll just buy a cow. I'll buy a sheep. It'll be easier. You don't have to worry about plowing regulations, planting parameters. I could just milk the cow and share the wool from the sheep. So she sells and she buys two sheep. All she wants is a warm sweater for the summer, this poor cold almana. So she shares the sheep. Who comes walking in now? Well, Moshe is busy today. You know, he's probably abusing some other orphan or homeless person. But Aaron now walks in, and Aaron comes in and says, "Tanalias Abacharos, I get the firstborn woman. Pass it over. How dare you think you could earn a living and clothe your poor little children?" He gives Mangziza. So she gives Aaron the firstborn, but she, of course, has other sheep. Now she wants to share the wool and says, "Wait, you got to give me Rachel's Agez, the first part of the shorn wool." Says, "You know what? I can't take this anymore. I'll be cold for the winter. I won't have milk to drink. These rabbis, they're ruining religion. They're exploiting orphans and widows. At least on my way out, let me have one good meal. Let me have my last meal. I'll shech the animal, have a nice big steak meal, and then I'll find out what to do. I'll have a full belly, and I'll learn to deal with this abuse and exploitation." So she shechts it. And what happens? Aaron comes back and says, "Oh, very interesting. I heard you sacrificed an animal. I heard you slaughtered an animal tonight. Let's pay up, woman. Where's the arm? Where's the cheek? Where's the keva? Zerah l'chayayin b'keva." Oh, she says, I can't take this. Every move I try to make, left and right, Trumos, Mysos, Leket, Shechla, Rishis, like, I say, "No, I'll just give it to charity." And now Aaron walks in, smiling from ear to ear. He's got his fish baited. "Oh, you said the word cherem? It's all mine. You can hear the echo. Mine. Flashes like a black and white film or something in some Hitchcockian fashion. Alfred Hitchcock at his best. No one's crying. I guess you're Karach immune. Because the mob was angry. They weaponized their pitchforks. They had their torches ready to burn Moshe and Aaron. Because after all, isn't that what religion is? It's abusive. It's exploitative. Look at the story of the widow and the two orphans. All she wanted was to support Molly and Pa and Holly, and then she couldn't. All she wanted was a sweater for the winter. And Aaron and Moshe just abused her." Boys, this is called demagoguery. This is not what halacha is. Halacha is 99.56% of the population, they're wealthy and sturdy enough and sustainable enough that they give the charity and they offer the rachis, I guess, and they have clothing and they have food and that's how you sustain a society, by creating public welfare and public charity. This is necessary for social welfare. And ultimately, social welfare is absolutely critical for personal welfare. You don't live in an island. Society around you crumbles, and personal wealth will also be forfeited. Now, are there people for whom the circumstances and the frustrations of life have conspired to create extreme poverty and extreme desperation, and for them, trumos u'maisros and rachis hages will be overwhelming? Of course there are. For those people, adjustments will be made. Maybe the Kohen will be Malchel. Maybe the Kohen will take it and give it back. Maybe we'll replenish them with the tzedakah that others have donated through the Leket Shechan Peah coffers. You're talking about 0.00005% of the population. Or even if you're talking about a half of a percentage point, the halachic system has adjustments that allow to compensate them rather than dooming them and condemning them to starvation and to freezing in the winter. But a demagogue, and this is the definition of demagoguery, can look at any person, organization, or system of beliefs. Are you listening? You judge people, you judge organizations of people, schools, shuls, parties, whatever, when we organize together as groups for common purpose, or belief systems. There's a system of belief that we live our life by, morality, religion, whatever. And though they seem to be beneficial, facilitating human welfare, he can find the flaw. She can find the flaw. And you'll use that flaw, that one fail, to subvert belief in the entire person, organization, or system. Oh, if there's a woman out there who's being exploited by halacha, halacha itself must be exploitative. Halacha itself must be male chauvinistic. Halacha itself must be insensitive and heartless and cruel. Halacha's cruel. All the money she's dedicating are for poor people and for Kohanim to facilitate performance of the Beis HaMikdash. And any society has to both support its weakest links as well as create a cadre of spiritual vanguard that will be able to represent the people. I mean, even the most secular Israeli, even the one who's ardently opposed to the Haredi culture, would still concede that We have to create a vanguard of spiritual leaders. The question is, in their minds, there are only 70,000, 80,000, whatever the numbers are at. The original arrangement with Ben-Gurion and the Chazon Ish was 300 people, 400 people. So that everyone agreed that we need. That's called demagoguery. Where when most people look at halacha and say, wow, this is a really balanced system. This accounts for all needs and social welfare. You'll find the one case, look at my hands, you'll grab it, you'll spin it, you'll bloat it and exaggerate it, amplify it beyond proportion, and cast it as representative of the entire system. That's part of leitzanus. That's the same thing of cynicism. When you make a cynical remark about a person, instead of seeing the good in that person and celebrating and accounting for whatever flaws or negativity you pick up and saying, well, it's part of the entire person's being and no one's perfect, you'll take that one flaw or that one detriment and you'll obsess about it, you'll attach your mind to it, you'll render it larger than life and characteristic of the person, you'll break that person down with your cynicism. Now, that's what I mentioned before, cynicism at any level, whether it's demagoguery, whether it's cynicism, sarcasm, disrespectful comedy to people, it's something which smarter people are prone to because they're better at analytics. And more intelligent people can always find the flaw in everything. Less intelligent people tend to be more accepting and believing. I see what I see, and it strikes me as positive, and it strikes me as beneficial, so why should I question it? But some people that are so trained in the analytics and the ability to see everything from three different angles, so automatically you're always looking for the flip side of something, and when it's driven by venomous or vitriol, then you're always easy to reject things. And the challenge is to be both. The challenge is to be someone who's skilled in analytics and understands the world whole and large and is able to understand multiple standpoints and dimensions of an idea, but still to see the overall benefit and to see the good and to celebrate the good and the positive rather than latching onto the negative. So in Korach, there's no cynicism. It's a different expression, but it comes from the same tendency. It's called leitzanus. One expression is cynicism, sarcasm. One expression is demagoguery. It's the same root. It's taking the negative and spinning it out of proportion and thereby either vocally deriding or defaming or at least trying to subvert belief in a person, organization, or system of ideas because you found the flaw. And this is classic. I mean, this is, if you look at it, it's classic. It's just so foolish. That's your convincing argument for the futility of halacha, that you found one case in which it fails. Every system has its fail. And every system has to account for its failures and create frameworks to adjust and to assist. This is really reflective of the fact that halacha... So train yourself, first of all. Listen carefully, because I hope this will be helpful for you in life. Train yourself to discern demagoguery. Sometimes people will make statements and arguments that are very demagogic. They're just silly. They're finding one case, and they're trying to employ that case as characteristic and thereby assert a position or reject a policy. It's just demagoguery. That's not reflective. That's exceptional. That's unique. That's a confluence of circumstances. Right? Most people are not widows with two orphans. And if they are, they have an estate left over. And they're going to face a situation where that one sheep will be the difference between food being fed and not being fed. Some people are. We'll adjust for the system. Let me give you another example of Korach's demagoguery. Probably the story you're most familiar with. What does Korach do? He assembles an entire mob. Second day, day two of his incitement. What does he talk about? Tcheles. Because the beged of the tzitzis, the actual garment, could be any color. It could be white, it could be red, it could be yellow, it could be any color you want. The minhag is to keep it white. So he trumps around, dances around, preens around with Moshe Rabbeinu with a shirt of tcheles. The entire garment is tcheles, like my shirt. But real tchelos, but this color. And then he asked Moshe, do I have to add a string of tchelos? And he's setting Moshe up. It's a set, it's a bait. It's a trap. Wait a second. I need to put strings on this blue shirt? The entire shirt is tchelos. I could bring a black shirt and one string of tchelos would carry, would factor. And now I've got an entire shirt, 500 times the surface area of this string that's tchelos. I put a few extra strings of tchelos on. That's embarrassing argumentation. Anyone who knows halacha knows there are different functions. And a shirt has one function, a string has another function. Okay, switch function. The tchelis is necessary specifically in the strings. Since we didn't get a chance to speak about tchelis and tzitzis last week, let me just tell you one nice idea. I was actually over Shabbos somewhere, and they asked me, I forget how, but we had this conversation over the Shabbos table. People want to know, if you choose to put on tchelis, which tchelis should you choose? They don't really have a masara. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't ask him because they didn't have tchelis. Generally, what I tell people, and I've encouraged some people who came to me in the last couple of weeks, is it depends. If you want to go with the standard look that your tzitzis have had these couple hundred years and just add tchelis to it, it's probably Tosas Ashita. Tosas Ashita tchelis looks the most like classic tzitzis, just with tchelis added. So if you want the classic look, go with Tosas. When I asked Rav Lichtenstein that question, and he was someone who didn't even wear tchelis, he said that he felt, if you want to wear tchelis, go with the Rambam. The Rambam's tchelis is four strings with half a string is tchelis. So when you fold the four into, when you fold it over and create eight, you've got one out of eight of blue and seven out of eight of white. And essentially, the way you create the tzitzis effect is the tzitzis are the white strings and the half string, one of eight, is the wrapping. So you've got seven tzitzis of white being wrapped by blue and then ending up merging at the end of the train, at the end of the trail. And the Rav talked about this both halachically as well as conceptually. And I more or less just summarized the halachic lamdish aspect that according to the Rambam, the tchelis is not equal to the white. It's a wrapper, it's a psil tchelis, so therefore you only need half in order to facilitate wrapping. But the Rav spoke about it more from a experiential standpoint. The Gemara says when you think about your tzitzis and you see the tchelis, you think about the sea. And when you think about the sea, you think about the sky. When you think about the sky, you think about the kisei hakavod, which at least is associated with the color blue based on the pasuk the end of Mishpatim. Now come on, guys. Where are our Australian representatives? Okay. Is the water really blue? Come on, where do you live, in Melbourne or Sydney? So tell us, is Sydney's known as a beach town, right? Is the water really blue?
Some days, yeah.
It's not blue. The water is colorless. You took out a cup of water from the sea, it'd be colorless, the last I checked. Blue is the illusion, the color that large bodies of impenetrable water through which your eyes and other forms of rays can pierce. It gives off the hue of blue. But it's not, the water isn't blue. The ocean isn't blue. It creates that effect because it's unfathomable. It's deep. It's an abyss. It's deeper than... Is the sky blue? The sky's not blue. The sky's colorless. It's just guesses. Not blue, but it gives that appearance. When you take something that's so large and so deeply layered that you can't see through it and light doesn't pierce it as, let's say, color and adhere to it in the regular form of color, but color adheres to objects, it emits a bluish hue. The Rav claimed that that's the interplay between the white and the blue in tzitzis. The white represents logic, ration, cognition, clarity. The blue represents irrational parts of religion, mysterious, unknowable, unfathomable. The core of Avodas Hashem is to try to understand religion, but it has to be wrapped as a prerequisite in the recognition that you can't understand religion. So you take the core and you wrap it, the packaging, the framework has to be, I'll never understand everything about religion. The framework, the assumption is tchelis. Now let me try to convert as much as I can into lavan, into the wine of tzitzis, which is a beautiful image of tzitzis. So everything has function and symbolism, and the beged has a different function. Tell me, Garch, he studied Maseches Menachos. I mean, anyone who asks that question after even a week of being in yeshiva would be laughed out of the room. That's a childish question. He knows it, of course. But he's using it to ridicule the system. He's using it to poke holes in the halachic logic. Well, it doesn't make sense. Of course, it doesn't make sense if you haven't studied. If you study, it makes perfect sense. So often when I hear people who struggle with perceived halachic inconsistency, it's simply just haven't spent time studying the system. They're looking at it from the outside. They're looking at the way the bells and levers operate. Now you know. There's something that you're in the process of transforming into your insiders. You know that they're There are deep, deep ideas that you have to study months and months and months just to crack and understand, and then begin to articulate whether it makes sense to you. Just to sit at the Shabbos table because something doesn't appear to you to be sensible, that's not moral criminality. It's just intellectual humiliation. Just you're making a fool out of yourself. When I start articulating ideas of physics, I hardly know physics. I'd study it for a while just to get beachhead and to be able to articulate some ideas. Okay, this doesn't seem evident or can't clarify this issue. Same with Torah. But Korach's fomenting the mob. Korach gathers them in a similar vein and says, what if you have an entire room of Sifrei Torah? Are you kidding me? Wrap two sections from Parshas Vayeschanan and Ekev, Kriyashma, and put it on the doorpost? It's ridiculous. You've got 1,000 Sifrei Torah in the room. And the answer is, of course it's not ridiculous, because there's a difference between Torah texts that you study from, and they have to be made available, sometimes in large quantities. And then there's a symbolic, experiential aspect of putting the parak of Shema Yisrael on your doorpost. To frame your existence, to frame your residence, to kiss it on your way out, to feel that Hashem Yishmerecha B'Karoi Shema Asaf Shecha. There are two different functions. If you put an entire Sefer Torah on the wall, you know, Yotzeh, Mezuzah, it has to be those three parshas because of the unique statements condensed in those parshas. Let's say take a Sefer Torah and paste it onto the doorpost. You're not Yotzeh, it's not a Mezuzah. It's not a Mezuzah. It's like, I feel like I'm talking to a kindergarten. He knows it, Korach. He understands it, but he's fomenting. 1 second. And that's classic demagoguery. We don't talk substantively. You twist the system. You're smart enough to find the loophole. You're smart enough to find the flaw. Politics of people and personality rather than politics of substance. A lot of that going on in our world today. No substantive conversation, at least in the United States of America. They're all just trying to bring each other down, find the scandal, pursuing one another, trying to dismantle leadership. And unfortunately, it becomes addictive. And what worries me is not what happens in politics, but for so many people, the political culture shapes personal culture and personal experience. And I worry that you guys will become less substantive. I worry that you guys will become demagogic, and you guys will become scandal-driven rather than substance-driven. And you respect people and their ideas and discuss them and debate them and offer your ideas and find some compromise between the ideas and find some... I feel like the whole world's turning into Korach. The whole political chatter is all Korach-based. It's all demagoguery. It's all personality-driven. It's all trying to assassinate personality. And that's how he leads the mob. So pretty cool in an eerie way that you're reading Parshas Korach in 2017 and you feel like we're absorbed in a culture of Korach. I'm sorry. What's that saying? Yes, quickly.
Just, if there's a kindergarten argument and you can see that, how did the mob not fall for
it? Because some people are really good at making childish arguments. And when there's a lot of people around, it's even easier. Trust me, I met one of the greatest demagogues I think the Jewish world has ever known. His name is Meir Kahana. If you study his history, he was a demagogue. He said some very nasty things. When I was in university, I wasn't involved in politics. I stayed in the base matters, kept my head low, did my courses, studied as hard as I could. I did three things in college. I slept, I learned Torah, and I studied for my degree. Kept my head above everything else. I attended one political function in Yeshiva University. That was a failed protest when Meir Kahana came to Yeshiva University to speak. Because he had said nasty things about Rav Schechter and Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Lichtenstein in various articles. And we felt that in the Beis Medrash, we felt it was our responsibility of Kavod HaTorah. So the entire Beis Medrash emptied to protest. That's why it was such a failed protest. We weren't such good protests. It was like... The Tosfos didn't get anywhere. Like, you can ask all the Rosh Hashivas today if while you were there, like all my friends, I'm not going to name them by name, but whoever's in Rosh Hashiva now, we're standing there together. So you can imagine how good we are. We're not hecklers, we're not jugglers, we weren't really screamers. And I saw the way he played the crowd, and I saw the way he answered questions. And let me give you an example, okay? My naivete. My question to his was, because he walked around camouflaging his rancor and his hostility as rabbinics. I'm a rabbi, Rabbi this, or so I don't. I'm like Rabbi Lichtenstein. I'm like Rabbi Soloveitchik. You know, they're contaminating Jewish thought with Western ideas, and I'm the true Jewish thought peddler. And so I asked him the question, a way of protest. I said, I raised my hand. was like 1986, that's a long time ago. Raised my hand and I said, let me ask you a question. At that point, I had already lost it. You don't ask a demagogue a question. So let me ask you a question. You present yourself as a rav, and yet all you talk about are killing Arabs and displacing Arabs, and those are the only shurim you give. Why don't we ever hear a shir from you on Migal Hotzai? So remember, I use that Migal Hotzai Lamrina. Why don't we ever hear a shir from you on Basar B'chalav? I just picked a couple shirim that you'd expect Rabbanim to deliver, someone of accomplishment and level. So he looks at me, he says, what's your name, young man? I said, I'm Moshe Tavagin. He said, where do you live? I told him where he lived. And of course, he could feel the crowd being whipped into a frenzy. He said, you come to my yeshiva the next time you're in so-and-so, and I'll give you a shir on that. Yeah, well, that wasn't an answer. He couldn't. No, maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. But it wasn't my question. My question was not whether he's going to give me a shir. My question is, rabbis shouldn't go around and spend all their time talking about killing people. The question is, if you're a rabbi, teach people Torah. You have a political opinion, say it or not say it, but you can't prostitute rabbinic title just for any political agenda, let alone one which is so aggressive and violent. But he answered the question. It's made fun of me. He made fun of a 19-year-old innocent little boy who wasn't good at heckling. And kahina v'chahina. So you'd be surprised. And he came traveling with 20 people who were sitting in the front two rows and everything. He said, the clock. He could have read from the phone book. Held up the placards. And so it wasn't a substantive conversation. So I walked away from that. Anyway, what do we have? In a few minutes, so let's just talk about what deceived Korach. Because Chazal are well aware of this question, what was he thinking? It wasn't just Barbara Walters, the interviewer. This is Chazal's question. Let's see if we can paraphrase Chazal. Source number Aleph, part 5. The Korach, Shepikea Chaya, Ma Ra L'shtus Hazeh. What were you thinking? This is Moshe. It's a 500-pound gorilla. You're not going to win this fight. You're going to get creamed. You get clobbered. Who are you playing? Take it on the Warriors. He lives by 40. Sorry. There's no light at the end of this tunnel. There's no fairy tale ending. What were they thinking? What was Korach thinking? So Chazal say he was taken astray by that most dangerous of vices. What's the most dangerous vice to tempt the human heart? Well, there's some very terrible and toxic ones. Greed, jealousy, material pleasure, pettiness, lust, hedonism, plenty, plenty of vices. But you see, with all those yetzeharas, you know that you're at war. The battle is clear. The enemy is explicit. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But you know that all these traits are deadly and toxic and unholy. And when you cave, you know that you're being conquered by a foreign element. You're sad about it. Hopefully you feel guilty. And at least you have a clear recovery process, or at least recovery horizon. What happens when there's a trait that you feel and truly is part of religious vision and inspiration and service and avodas Hashem, but can also ensnare you when you're not watching? That's a truly dangerous trait. And that's the trait called ego and ambition. Because without ego and ambition, you won't believe in yourself. And without ego and ambition, you won't express your talent or develop your talent or believe you can accomplish anything. And hopefully, though, that dedication and desire will be channeled to selfless leadership. You're not in it for yourself. You want to be a leader, assist others, teach Torah, lead our people, be a difference maker, lead organizations. So it's absolutely necessary that you believe in yourself and that your ego attaches itself to visions. Sometimes it can grab you and lead you rather than you leading it, and it leads you into some very, very immoral, questionable behavior, crossing all sorts of moral red lines, and just acting insane. And that's the profile of Korach. Korach wasn't just smart, he was a prophet. And Korach saw that one day, there'd be a great descendant of his that radically changed the Jewish people in the Jewish constellation. Who is that descendant of Korach? Shmuel. Look at me, and you can see Korach's eyes. I'm the one. I'm the chosen. It's my breed. It's my progeny. It's my descendants. Of course I'm going to succeed. By definition, I can't lose. Because it's woven into the destiny of the Am Yisrael, to the historical DNA. It's part of the genome. My descendants are going to check. I can do anything. I can challenge Moshe's authority. I've got carte blanche. I'm Superman. Got a bulletproof chest plate. Nothing pierces that. And that's what Chazal is selling Korach. Efshar, line number 3, source 5. Efshar ha-gedula ha-zeo ha-sida la-mod mimeni. I'm going to be such a great person through Shmuel v'ani Edom, and I'll stay quiet. La ra yafa. He's blinded by the light. He's blinded by the light of his own ego. He doesn't realize, well, maybe his sons will do tshuva, other ways to reconcile how Korach dies and Shmuel lives. That's the dangerous trait of ego and ambition. And I'm not here to tell you to in any way suppress your ego and ambition. I'm here just to ask you to scrutinize it very, very carefully. And we'll talk about it at greater length throughout the rest of the year. I don't want to take you away from too much ego, not enough falafel. So you actually get some falafel also. Next letter in the alphabet. So talking about ego, you're probably thinking about falafel. But be careful. And Korach is drawn away, drawn into lunacy, momentary lunacy, faithful, fatal lunacy, because he believes that he's invulnerable because he's so talented and has such an important role to play. Go get the falafel. I was in a, who asked me? I was in Ranana or something, and someone said, why do you call Glenn Hazel something? Someone listens like every shoe right here. I said, because you're listening to him in the spring of the summer, when Elokan's going to be back to Detroit.
I'm
going to
wrap
up
on a
like,
Kalazi.
Thank you.
Kalazi was heat for a lot of
you. You know, yeah, team, you know.